Hello, welcome to Voice on Record with me, Sean Williams. You're listening to Resonance 104.4 FM, resonancefm.com. Today's program is about India. Well, it's not about India, but it features recordings made in India and around the subject of India. There's a long excerpt of Boris Karloff reading from the Jungle Book, Kipling's Jungle Book, which I'm going to play at the end, towards the end of the show. There's a couple of speeches by Mahatma Gandhi, a little snippet of Nehru, and some other sort of slightly more random things. And I'll start off with a recording which doesn't have a date on it, but it's an American recording. Judging by the figures, you could probably work backwards and figure out when it was recorded. Here it is.
If you were to ask an Indian to describe his country, he would probably begin by saying, well, India is such a vast country. 1,000,000 square miles, that's how vast it is. On its northern border, the highest mountains in the world stand, the Himalayas, whose name means abode of snows. India's own name came from an ancient Sanskrit word meaning river. Through the ages, many great rivers such as the Ganges and the Jamuna have carried soil down from the mountains and spread it over northern India in a vast fertile plain. This plain is one of the most densely populated areas in the world, with 406 people living on every square mile of it. In the United States, there are only 54 people per square mile, and in Canada, 5. South of the river plain, the country is mountainous and topped with a high plateau called the Deccan, where wheat and cotton grow. On the east and west, the mountains drop steeply to tropical seacoasts where coconut palms sway and pearl divers are at work. Peppers, cinnamon, and ginger grow here, for these are the fabulous spice coasts that Columbus was searching for when he found America. The 550 million people who live in India are as varied as its geography. The majority live in villages and farm for a living, but that's one of the few generalities you can make. When it comes to race, religion, languages, and customs, you'll find a bewildering variety in India. People may be fair-skinned or dark. The clothes they wear range from the chic-like dhoti and the graceful sari through skirts for men in some regions or an ancient style of trousers for women right up to modern Western dress in the big cities. Indians in different parts of the country speak 17 different languages and 800 dialects. In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth.
Devasati mutha gushti karnya cha prayatna kara.
Madat sari, devudu, prapuncham, akashum, tayar jesnadu.
Adil kadavudu, agasam bhoomiyai padaita. Adil deyum, agasam bhoomiyai srishtichu.
Tongues like Hindi, Tamil, and Gujarati sound strange to Westerners, but when you listen closely, you'll find that Indians have adopted many English words, while we have learned to use many of theirs. Pajama, for example, veranda, and even the name of the game, Parcheesi, the root of which means 25 in Hindustani. You'll find Indian names of people beautiful. Moti means pearl. Kamala, lotus, that's a favorite name for girls. Or Sitara, morning star. Arun is a man's name. It means sun, and it's about as common in India as John is in North America. Religion is very important in India. Hindu temples dot the landscape, for the majority are Hindus. There are many mosques, too. 50 million Indians are Muslims. 14 million Christians form the third largest religious group. Then there are turbaned Sikhs who greet each other saying, Sat Siri Akal, which means truth is immortal. There are Jains who believe that every living creature has a soul and they try not to kill even an insect. There are Parsis, a modern, well-educated community whose ancestors were sun worshippers from Persia coming to India centuries ago fleeing persecution. Put them all together, all the religions, languages, races, and traditions, and you have India, the largest democracy in the world.
So you've got a certain strange perspective and a tone all of its own there, partly explained by the fact that the record is made under the auspices of the National Council of Churches in the States. So, you know, there's an agenda with every every recording, but I'm trying not to make any judgments and just play material that you can listen to in any kind of way you like. Now, the next recording is an excerpt of Gandhi speaking I believe it's in the Asian Relations Conference in New Delhi on April the 2nd, 1947. But it's slightly tricky to work it out. This is one of just a few very short excerpts I have of Gandhi speaking himself, and it's quite a thing just to listen to his actual speaking voice. I guess many of us just picture Ben Kingsley in the film. So often that's how we get information mediated to us. But this is Gandhi himself speaking in India in the 40s.
See, perhaps some of you, a few villages of India, then you will find real India. Today, I will make this admission also, that you will not be fascinated by the sight. You will have then to scratch down below the dung heaps that the villages are today. I don't pretend to say that they were ever places of paradise, but today they are really dung heaps. They were not like that before, of that I'm quite sure. But that I speak not from history, but from what I have seen myself with my physical eyes of India, and I have traveled from one end of India to the other, seen these villages, seen the miserable specimens of humanity, lusterless eyes, and yet they are India. And yet in those humble cottages, in the midst of those dung heaps, are to be found the humble Gangis, where you will find concentrated essence of wisdom.
And that's the voice of Mahatma Gandhi. Now, just to stay with the historical recordings just for a moment, there's another, just a couple of months later, on the 15th of August in the same year, in 1947, we have a recording of Nehru's speech on the independence of India. And you can hear the crowds in the background shouting Mahatma Gandhiji.
At the stroke of the midnight hour, when the world sleeps, India will awake to life and freedom.
There's a powerful recording indeed, and one which for me really illustrates the value of background noise and the sort of things that you can actually lose if you got sort of follow this mad pursuit of high fidelity, what people call high fidelity and noiseless recordings and this sort of thing. There's so much extra things that you lose. I have a recording of Nehru's speech on a different record that actually edits out the shouting of the crowds. I mean, it's a recording of the speech, and it focuses on the speech particularly, but the loss of the extraneous noise is you're just losing so much of just the valuable information, the sort of the ecological information that's there at the time, which I kind of really value, and it's something that you hear a lot of the closer you listen to these kind of recordings. So I'm going to move on now, something slightly less serious in sort of political aspect, and I'm going to introduce to you a recording of the Maharishi Mahesh Yogi, the Beatles guru, or made famous in the eyes of the West, certainly through its association with the Beatles, or the Beatles' association with him. The title of this talk is The Untapped Source of Power That Lies Within, and it was issued on Liberty Records. The thing that really interests me about this, amongst other things, is the kind of cosmic nature that's it's sort of imbued into the recording by the use of the colossal reverb. Try not to let that worry you, but just sit back and enjoy it.
Our life is the expression of our inner potentialities. We project ourselves to the extent we know of our inner status. And there is much more to life than that which we are already living. Let us consider what more there is to life and what more can be lived than that we are living in the present. Certainly, it is wise to know the whole extent of an expression of our life and to try to bring it in all that we have been missing so far. We know if we drop a stone in a pond, the ripples begin to move, and they move over the whole pond, reaching all the extremities. One slight stir in any part of a pond stirs the whole pond, influences the entire field of water and its surroundings. Similarly, by every thought, word, and action, every individual is setting forth influence in his surroundings, and that influence is not restricted to any boundaries. It goes on and reaches every level of creation. Every individual, by his every thought, word, and action, shakes the entire universe. This is the status of an individual. One is connected with the whole universe by every little bit of his activity. An individual appears to be bound by the boundaries of home and the boundaries of his own body. But in reality, the subtle aspects of the individuality go to make universal existence. An individual is never an isolated individual. He is intimately interrelated with the whole cosmos. Even more than that, he shares the responsibility for the life of the whole cosmos. The entire universe lies in the individual. Cosmic existence lies in the existence of the individual. Cosmic life rests in the individual life, and the individual life extends to cosmic life. The individual and the cosmos are interdependent. Neither of them is independent of the other. Every move of the individual shakes the cosmos. The universe reacts to the individual action. Every individual has this power that shakes the universe and shakes and saves the gods and angels in heaven. Man has this strength that upholds the universe. The individual, by his every action, serves the universe, and the great power of nature is ready to serve the individual if the individual influences the universe for the progression of the process of evolution. By its very existence, the creation is set in motion to go on and on through the steps of evolution. If the action of the individual is in conformity with the purpose of creation and the purpose of evolution, then the individual serves the cosmic purpose of life, and all the great laws of nature readily serve the purpose of the individual. It is a simple and automatic process of give and take. As you sow, so shall you reap. When the individual behaves rightly, he improves and by so doing, he contributes to the betterment of the entire universe. But when knowingly or unknowingly he behaves wrongly, he acts contrary to the process of evolution. The laws of nature begin to react against him. The individual receives back the result of his wrong actions. If we think right, speak good, and act truthfully, we receive the support of all the laws of nature, carrying out the process of evolution around us. Naturally, when we serve the government, we enjoy all the advantages of the laws of the government, because all the laws are to serve the individual interest. We as individuals have the influence over the whole universe, every one of us influences the entire universe by every little action we perform. Obviously, we do not perceive it, but at every moment, we are either supporting or damaging the entire universe. Better we forget not the great responsibility that we can do and undo the entire creation that breathes the life of God by the simple individual mistakes of ours. The wrong, once done, cannot be undone. It returns to us from all sides. Everything suffers for our wrongdoing, and we are made to suffer for the suffering of all. Thou shalt reap the consequences of thy doings is the fair policy of Mother Nature. She only wants her children to enjoy. But while enjoying the flowers in the garden of God, those who walk loosely falter and fall unduly. The joy of life is there. It depends on us whether we make use of our power and use it or lose it. Better we produce the influence of all harmony, and we will do this by virtue of our natural ability to think, speak, and act rightly. Our individuality will then command the power of the universe. Make use of the cosmic power of the individual law in favor of our desire, and use cosmic life energy for the health and great accomplishments in life. The unlimited source of cosmic life energy is at our disposal. We have only to begin to use it. The great cosmic intelligence lies at our disposal. We have only to connect our individual mind with the cosmic intelligence, with the universal mind, and gain all clarity of thinking and all success in activity, and live a life of eternal freedom on earth. The great possibility of our individual life contacting the universal cosmic life energy and intelligence is here at hand. Eternity lies in the present. Eternity always in the hands of the present. It only needs to be appreciated. The present holds the master key to unlock the treasures of eternity. Every moment of our life is supplemented with the eternity of the bygone past and that which awaits us in all the moments to come. Eternal existence of the unlimited cosmos is available to us for all power. Certainly, as we have seen, we are influencing the entire cosmic life. But somehow, we are not making use of the great, unlimited and vast resources of nature that are at all times available to us. We are always giving. Through every thought, word and action, we are producing an influence in the cosmos. We are always giving. Certainly, we want to give out to our atmosphere all harmony, all peace, all happiness, all love, all serenity and grace. Because this alone is useful and life-supporting. Certainly, we want to create a better life, healthier and more useful surroundings. Therefore, it is of vital importance that we should know where to receive this great life energy, greater happiness, greater intelligence, greater harmony, greater serenity and grace. Yes, there is a primal source of all happiness from which spreads all happiness that is found in the world. There is a primordial power of life energy.
Well, I'm just going to allow the Maharishi to drift off there gradually. It's a very long record, and I'm pretty convinced that they speeded up the tape there in order to fit the whole speech onto onto one side of the record. It's two quite long pieces. I could be completely wrong, but if you put it on sort of -4 or -8% on a Technics deck, it sounds a lot more convincing. I don't know. How do you describe it? Anyway, that's as it was released at 33 and a third RPM, strictly. So moving on, or moving back, I should say, we're going to find another short excerpt from the Friendship recording called Listening In on India, which was the American recording from the top of the show. Now, I'm not sure who this is speaking, but it's dealing with the problem of hippies.
You know, in America, there is one movement named as Jesus Movement, and the origin of this movement is from this hippie only. As far as I know, and as I have read the article in the Times, they say that the origin of the Jesus Movement is from hippie. When they see these hippies coming from America, when they see these hippies taking the opium and like sleeping somewhere, they have got some inner desire to do so. They think that these persons are the happiest persons of the world. This is what the modern Indian psychology. And naturally, when a man is very much frustrated and he will see somebody sleeping with all his comforts and all that, he would like to become like that. So, you know, we Indians, I should say, without understanding the deep philosophy of these hippies, we are simply going for them. And I don't know what we'll do after all this, but this is somewhat bad sign for we Indians. This much I can say.
So, echoing or reversing even the phenomenon of foreign people coming into India, we're going to go back to Gandhi talking for a short while about his experiences in South Africa as an Indian abroad. It's a very short excerpt with a little bit of commentary at the end, but don't be fooled by the brevity of the speech in terms of the weight of the content.
I was, that is my countrymen, in a hopeless minority. Not only hopeless minority, but a despised minority. If the Europeans of South Africa will forgive me for saying so. We were all coolies. I was an insignificant coolie lawyer. At that time, we had no coolie doctors. We had no coolie lawyers. I was the first in the field. Nevertheless, a coolie.
He was born an ordinary man with ordinary capacities, and he literally hammered himself into shape. He chiseled himself into shape. He hammered himself into shape as the case arose. He was a self-educated, self-made man, consciously determined to make himself an instrument of the values which he prized.
So moving back to India itself again, I'm going to play you another recording from the Friendship recording, Listening In on India record. It's a kind of a pretty strange affair of an attempt at a sort of sound picture. You get some interesting sounds, but the way it's put together is pretty clunky. And, you know, you kind of wouldn't do it that way nowadays, but hey, goodness knows when it was recorded. And it has a lot of value for some things like the Chaiwala on the train. You just kind of wish the commentary would stop and you could get on with the sounds, which you're probably thinking about me speaking now. So here is the excerpt.
If you were to visit India, you would be struck by how very different the Indian life around you would look in comparison to, well, what you are used to seeing in your own hometown, your city or farm. If you were to shut your eyes and listen to the sounds around you, they would be just as strange as the sights you would see. So let's take a little trip with just our ears. The railway station platform sounds like this. At times, a food vendor passes by selling tea. Some baby chicks are in a crate on the platform, ready to be sent off to a nearby farm. Just outside the station, some boys are playing with a toy that sounds like a drum rattle. Oh, and across the street a camel goes by pulling a cart. A few steps farther, we stop to listen to some workmen loading a heavy cement mixer onto a truck. And around the corner at a zoo, a white tiger speaks his mind. A nearby dove says, "Cool it, cool it." And some children in a birdhouse try to identify the many tropical birds they see. Outside the zoo gates on a very busy street, a snake charmer is coaxing his cobra out of a basket with his flute. As we go down the street, some boys follow us. And they try their very best to sing their own Indian national anthem. Farther on, we enter the hustle and bustle of a big city market in Old Delhi. But to hear the sounds of the rural India, where 80% of the population live, we listen to the sounds on a country road at dusk when farmers are returning to their homes. Bullock carts pass by. Birds sing. Farmers talk as they pass. Well, listen and figure it out for yourselves with your own ears.
Huh?
Now, some sounds of India there, recorded at an unspecified time and date. But who knows, 60s, 70s, anybody's guess, really. Although you could probably trace it back, judging from the population figures quoted in the earlier recording, which I played at the start of the show. Now, I've got another recording. I think I played in the very first show. I played some Boris Karloff reading Aesop's Fables, while Boris did quite a lot of recording for Cadman. And amongst one of the recordings is this recording, which I'm going to play one side of. I think there's the other side is him reading some of the Just So stories, which I've also got copies of, read by Michael Horden and I think Vanessa Redgrave. I could be wrong about the second one, but there are various versions of the Just So stories, but this is a recording of The Jungle Book as read by Boris Karloff. So again, this is a long one, so I hope you can sit back and enjoy it somewhere.
It was 7 o'clock of a very warm evening in the Seeonee Hills when Father Wolf woke up from his day's rest, scratched himself, yawned, and spread out his paws one after the other to get rid of the sleepy feeling in the tips. Mother Wolf lay with her big grey nose dropped across her four tumbling, squealing cubs, and the moon shone into the mouth of the cave where they all lived. "Ah," said Father Wolf, "it is time to hunt again." And he was going to spring downhill when a little shadow with a bushy tail crossed the threshold and whined, "Good luck go with you, O chief of the wolves, and good luck and strong white teeth go with the noble children, that they may never forget the hungry in this world." It was the jackal, Tabaki, the dish licker. And the wolves of India despise Tabaki because he runs about making mischief, telling tales, and eating rags and pieces of leather from the village rubbish heaps. Shere Khan, the big one, has shifted his hunting grounds. He will hunt among these hills during the next moon, so he has told me. Shere Khan was the tiger who lived near the Wainganga River, 20 miles away. Father Wolf listened, and in the dark valley that ran down to a little river, he heard the dry, angry, snarly, sing-song whine of a tiger who has caught nothing and does not care if all the jungle knows it. "The fool," said Father Wolf, "to begin a night's work with that noise. Does he think that our buck are like his fat Wainganga bullocks? Shh! 'Tis neither bullock nor buck that he hunts tonight," said Mother Wolf. "It is man." The whine had changed to a sort of humming purr that seemed to roll from every quarter of the compass. It was the noise that bewilders woodcutters and gypsies sleeping in the open and makes them run sometimes into the very mouth of the tiger. "Man," said Father Wolf, showing all his white teeth. "Ha! Are there not enough beetles and frogs in the tanks that he must eat man, and on our ground too?" "Something is coming uphill," said Mother Wolf, twitching one ear. "Get ready." The bushes rustled a little in the thicket, and Father Wolf dropped with his haunches under him, ready for his leap. Then, if you'd been watching, you would have seen the most wonderful thing in the world. The wolf checked in mid-spring. He made his bound before he saw what it was that he was jumping at, and then he tried to stop himself. The result was that he shot up straight into the air for 4 or 5 feet, landing almost where he left ground. "Man," he snapped, "a man's cub. Look!" Directly in front of him, holding on by a low branch, stood a small, naked brown baby who could just walk, as soft and as dimpled a little thing as ever came to a wolf's cave at night. And he looked up into Father Wolf's face and laughed. Is that a man's cub? Said Mother Wolf. I've never seen one. Bring it here. A wolf accustomed to moving his own cubs can, if necessary, mouth an egg without breaking it. And though Father Wolf's jaws closed right on the child's back, not a tooth even scratched the skin as he laid it down among the cubs. How little. How naked. And how bold, said Mother Wolf softly. Aye, he's taking his meal with the others. And so this is a man's cub. Now, was there ever a wolf that could boast of a man's cub among her children? I've heard now and again of such a thing, but never in our pack or in my time, said Father Wolf. He is altogether without hair, and I could kill him with a touch of my foot, but see, he looks up and is not afraid. The moonlight was blocked out of the mouth of the cave. For Shere Khan's great square head and shoulders were thrust into the entrance. Tabaki behind him was squeaking, my lord, it went in there. Shere Khan does us great honor, said Father Wolf, but his eyes were very angry. What does Shere Khan need? My quarry. A man's cub went this way, said Shere Khan. Its parents have run off. Give it to me. The wolves are a free people, said Father Wolf. They take orders from the head of the pack, not for any striped cattle killer. The cub man is ours to kill if we choose. Ye choose and ye do not choose. What talk is this of choosing? By the bull that I killed, am I to stand nosing into your dog's den for my fair dues? This is I, Shere Khan, who speak. The tiger's roar filled the cave with thunder. Mother Wolf shook herself clear of the cubs and sprang forward, her eyes like two green moons in the darkness, facing the blazing eyes of Shere Khan. And it is I, Ruksa, the demon, who answer. The man's cub is mine, Lungri, mine to me. He shall not be killed. He shall live to run with the pack and to hunt with the pack. And in the end, look you, hunter of little naked cubs, frog-eater, fish-eater, shall hunt thee. Now get thee hence, or by the Samba that I killed, I eat no starved cattle. Back thou goest to thy mother, burned beast of the jungle, lamer than ever thou camest into the world. Go! Father Wolf looked on amazed. He'd almost forgotten the days when he won Mother Wolf in fair fight from five other wolves, when she ran in the pack and was not called the demon for compliment's sake. Shere Khan might have faced Father Wolf, but he couldn't stand up against Mother Wolf, for he knew that where he was, she had all the advantage of the ground and would fight to the death. So he backed out of the cave mouth, growling, and when he was clear, he shouted, every dog barks in his own yard. We'll see what the pack will say to this fostering of man-cubs. The cub is mine, and to my teeth he will come in the end, O bush-tail thieves. Mother Wolf threw herself down, panting among the cubs. And Father Wolf said to her gravely, Shere Khan speaks this much truth. The cub must be shown to the pack. Wilt thou still keep him, mother? Keep him, she gasped. He came naked by night, alone and very hungry, and yet he was not afraid. Look, he has pushed one of my babes to one side already, and that lame butcher would have killed him and would have run off to the Waingunga while the villagers here hunted through all our lairs in revenge. Keep him. Assuredly I will keep him. Lie still, little frog. Oh, thou Mowgli. For Mowgli the frog I will call thee. The time will come when thou wilt hunt Shere Khan as he has hunted thee. But what will our pack say, said Father Wolf. The law of the jungle lays down very clearly that any wolf may, when he marries, withdraw from the pack he belongs to. But As soon as his cubs are old enough to stand on their feet, he must bring them to the pack council, which is generally held once a month at full moon, in order that the other wolves may identify them. Father Wolf waited till his cubs could run a little, and then on the night of the pack meeting took them and Mowgli and Mother Wolf to the council rock, a hilltop covered with stones and boulders where 100 wolves could hide. Akela, the great grey lone wolf, who led all the pack by strength and cunning, lay out at full length on his rock, and below him sat 40 or more wolves of every size and colour, from badger-coloured veterans who could handle a buck alone to young black three-year-olds who thought they could. And Akela from his rock would cry, "Ye know the law, ye know the law. Look well, O wolves." At last, and Mother Wolf's neck whistles lifted as the time came, Father Wolf pushed Mowgli the Frog, as they called him, into the center, where he sat laughing and playing with some pebbles that glistened in the moonlight. Akela never raised his head from his paws, but went on with a monotonous cry, "Look well, look well." A muffled roar came up from behind the rocks, the voice of Shere Khan crying, "The cub is mine, give him to me. What have the free people to do with a man's cub?" Akela never even twitched his ears. All he said was, "Look well, O wolves. What have the free people to do with the orders of any save the free people? Look well." There was a chorus of deep growls, and a young wolf in his fourth year flung back Shere Khan's question to Akela, "What have the free people to do with a man's cub?" Now the law of the jungle lays down that if there is any dispute as to the right of a cub to be accepted by the pack, he must be spoken for by at least two members of the pack who are not his father and mother. "Who speaks for this cub?" said Akela among the free people. "Who speaks?" There was no answer, and Mother Wolf got ready for what she knew would be her last fight, if things came to fighting. Then the only other creature who was allowed at the pack council, Balu, the sleepy brown bear who teaches the wolf cubs the law of the jungle. Old Balu, who can come and go where he pleases because he only eats nuts and roots and honey, rose up on his hind quarters and grunted, "The man's cub? The man's cub," he said. "I speak for the man's cub. There is no harm in a man's cub. I have no gift of words, but I speak the truth. Let him run with the pack and be entered with the others. I myself will teach him." "We need yet another," said Akela. "Balu has spoken, and he is our teacher for the young cubs. Who speaks besides Balu?" A black shadow dropped down into the circle. It was Bagheera, the black panther, inky black all over, but with the panther marking showing up in certain lights like the pattern of watered silk. Everybody knew Bagheera, and nobody cared to cross his path, for he was as cunning as Tabaki, as bold as the wild buffalo, and as reckless as a wounded elephant, but he had a voice as soft as wild honey dripping from a tree, and a skin softer than down. "O Akela, and ye the free people," he purred, "to kill a naked cub is shame. Besides, he may make far better sport for you when he is grown. Balu has spoken in his behalf. And now, to Balu's word, I will add one bull and a fat one, newly killed not half a mile from here, if ye will accept the man's cub according to the law. Is it difficult?" There was a clamor of a score of voices saying, "What matter? He'll die in the winter rains. He'll scorch in the sun. What harm can a naked frog do us? Let him run with the pack. Where is the bull Bagheera? Let him be accepted." And then came Arkela's deep bay crying, look well, O wolves. And that is how Mowgli was entered into the Seeonee wolf pack for the price of a bull and on Baloo's good word.
You're listening to Voice on Record on Resonance FM. This is a recording of Boris Karloff reading from Rudyard Kipling's Jungle Book. And we will go back into it at a later stage in the book.
Now, you must be content to skip 10 or 11 whole years and only guess at all the wonderful life that Mowgli led among the wolves, because if it were written out, it would fill ever so many books. He grew up with the cubs, though they, of course, were grown wolves almost before he was a child. And Father Wolf taught him his business and the meaning of things in the jungle, till every rustle in the grass, every breath of the warm night air, every note of the owls above his head, every scratch of a bat's claws as it roosted for a while in a tree, and every splash of every little fish jumping in a pool meant just as much to him as the work of his office means to a businessman. And he grew, and grew strong as a boy must grow, who doesn't know that he's learning any lessons, and who has nothing in the world to think of except things to eat. It was one very warm day that a new notion came to Bagheera, born of something that he had heard. Perhaps Hiki the porcupine had told him. But he said to Mowgli, when they were deep in the jungle, as the boy lay with his head on Bagheera's beautiful black skin, "Little brother, how often have I told thee that Shere Khan is thy enemy?" "Oh, as many times as there are nuts on that palm," said Mowgli, who naturally could not count. "What of it? I'm sleepy, Bagheera, and Shere Khan is all long tail and loud talk like Mao the peacock." "Open those eyes, little brother. Shere Khan dares not kill thee in the jungle for fear of those that love thee. But remember, Arkela is very old, and soon the day comes when he cannot kill his buck, and then he will be leader no more. Many of the wolves that looked thee over when thou wast brought to the council first are old too, and the young cubs believe, as Shere Khan has taught them, that a man-cub has no place with the pack. They hate thee because their eyes cannot meet thine, because thou art wise, because thou hast pulled out thorns from their feet, because thou art a man. It is in my heart that when Arkela misses his next kill, and at each hunt it costs him more to pin the buck, the pack will turn against him and against thee. They will hold a jungle council at the rock, and then... "I have it," said Bagheera, leaping up. "Go thou down quickly to the men's huts in the valley and take some of the red flower which they grow there, so that when the time comes, thou mayest have even a stronger friend than I or Baloo or those of the pack that love thee. Get the red flower." By red flower, Bagheera meant fire. Only no creature in the jungle will call fire by its proper name. Every beast lives in deadly fear of it and invents 100 ways of describing it. "The red flower," said Mowgli, "that grows outside their huts in the twilight? I will get some." "There speaks the man's cub," said Bagheera proudly. Mowgli was far and far through the forest running hard, and his heart was hot in him. And when the morning came and the mists were all white and cold, halfway up the hill he met Bagheera with the morning dew shining like moonstones on his coat. "Arkela has missed," said the panther. "They would have killed him last night, but they needed thee also. They were looking for thee on the hill." "I was among the ploughed lands. I am ready. Look!" Mowgli held up the firepot. "Good. Now, I have seen men thrust a dry branch into that stuff. and presently the red flower blossomed at the end of it. All that day Mowgli sat in the cave tending his fire pot and dipping dry branches into it to see how they looked. He found a branch that satisfied him, and in the evening, when Tabaqui came to the cave and told him, rudely enough, that he was wanted at the council rock, he laughed till Tabaqui ran away. Then Mowgli went to the council, still laughing. Akela, the lone wolf, sat by the side of his rock, as a sign that the leadership of the pack was open, and Shere Khan, with his following of scrap-fed wolves, walked to and fro openly, being flattered. Bagheera lay close to Mowgli, and the fire pot was between Mowgli's knees. When they were all gathered together, Shere Khan began to speak, a thing he would never have dared to do when Akela was in his prime. "He has no right," whispered Bagheera. "Say so. He is a dog's son. He will be frightened." Mowgli sprang to his feet. "Free people," he cried. "Does Shere Khan lead the pack? What has a tiger to do with our leadership?" "Seeing that the leadership is yet open and being asked to speak," Shere Khan began. "By whom?" said Mowgli. "Are we all jackals to fall on this cattle butcher? The leadership of the pack is with the pack alone." There were yells of "Silence, thou man's cub, let him speak. He has kept our law." And at last the seniors of the pack thundered, "Let the dead wolf speak." When the leader of the pack has missed his kill, he is called the dead wolf as long as he lives, which is not long as a rule. Then Shere Khan roared, "Bah, what have we to do with this toothless fool? He is doomed to die. It is the man cub who has lived too long. Free people, he was my meat from the first. Give him to me, for I am weary of this man-wolf folly. He has troubled the jungle for 10 seasons. Give me the man-cub, or I will hunt here always and not give you one bone. He is a man, a man's child, and from the marrow of my bones I hate him." "He is a man, a man, a man," snarled the pack. And most of the wolves began to gather round Shere Khan, whose tail was beginning to switch. "Now the business is in thy hands," said Bagheera to Mowgli. "We can do no more except fight." Mowgli stood upright, the fire pot in his hands. Then he stretched out his arms and yawned in the face of the council. But he was furious with rage and sorrow, for wolf-like, the wolves had never told him how they hated him. "Listen, you," he cried, "there is no need for this dog's jabber. Ye have told me so often tonight that I am a man, although indeed I would have been a wolf with you to my life's end, that I feel your words are true. So I do not call ye my brothers any more, but sag, dogs, as a man should. What ye will do and what ye will not do is not yours to say. That matter is with me. And that we may see the matter a little more plainly, I, the man, have brought here a little of the red flower which ye, dogs, fear." He flung the firepot on the ground, and some of the red coals lit a tuft of dried moss that flared up as all the council drew back in terror before the leaping flames. Mowgli thrust his dead branch into the fire till the twigs lit and crackled and whirled it above his head among the cowering wolves. "Thou art the master," said Bagheera in an undertone. "Save Akela from the death. He was ever thy friend." Akela, the grim old wolf who had never asked for mercy in his life, gave one piteous look at Mowgli as the boy stood all naked, his long black hair tossing over his shoulders in the light of the blazing branch that made the shadows jump and quiver. "Good," said Mowgli, staring around slowly and thrusting out his lower lip. "I see that ye are dogs. I go from you to my own people, if they be my own people. The jungle is shut to me, and I must forget your talk and your companionship, but I will be more merciful than ye are. Because I was all but your brother in blood, I promise that when I am a man among men, I will not betray ye to men as ye have betrayed me. But remember, when next I come to the Council Rock, as a man should come, it will be with Shere Khan's hide on my head. For the rest, Arkela goes free to live as he pleases. Ye will not kill him, because that is not my will. Nor do I think that ye will sit here any longer, lolling out your tongues as though ye were somebody's, instead of dogs whom I drive out thus. Go! The fire was burning furiously at the end of the branch, and Mowgli struck right and left round the circle, and the wolves ran howling with the sparks burning their fur. At last, there were only Arkela, Bagheera, and perhaps 10 wolves that had taken Mowgli's part. Then, something began to hurt Mowgli inside him, as he had never been hurt in his life before. And he caught his breath and sobbed, and the tears ran down his face. "What is it? What is it?" he said. "I do not wish to leave the jungle, and I do not know what this is. Am I dying, Bagheera?" "No, little brother. Those are only tears such as men use," said Bagheera. "Now I know thou art a man, and a man's cub no longer. The jungle is shut indeed to thee henceforward. Let them fall, Mowgli. They are only tears." So Mowgli sat and cried as though his heart would break, and he'd never cried in all his life before. "Now," he said, "now I will go to men. But first I must say farewell to my mother." And he went to the cave where she lived with Father Wolf, and he cried on her coat while the 4 cubs howled miserably. "You will not forget me," said Mowgli. "Never while we can follow a trail," said the cubs. "Come to the foot of the hill when thou art a man, and we will talk to thee, and we will come into the croplands to play with thee by night." "Come soon," said Father Wolf. "O wise little frog, come soon again, for we be old, thy mother and I." "Come soon," said Mother Wolf, "little naked son of mine, for listen, child of man, I love thee more than I ever loved my cubs." "I will surely come," said Mowgli. "And when I come, it will be to lay Shere Khan's hide upon the Council Rock. Do not forget me. Tell them in the jungle never to forget me." The dawn was beginning to break when Mowgli went down the hillside alone to the crops to meet those mysterious things that are called men.
That was Boris Karloff reading from Rudyard Kipling's The Jungle Book. You've been listening to Voice on Record with me, Sean Williams, on Resonance 104.4 FM, resonancefm.com. As always, if you'd like to get in touch or send an email, make any comments, complaints, suggestions, questions, queries, whatnot, please don't hesitate to send me an email at voiceonrecord@gmail.com. voiceonrecord@gmail.com. Next week we should have a program on, not sure actually, the Irish possibly, or, well, we'll have to see. It'll be on the website. But I'm going to leave you now with another very short speech by Mahatma Gandhi, and I hope you tune in again next week. Thanks for listening.
I do dimly perceive that whilst everything around me is ever changing, ever dying, there is underlying all that change a living power that is changeless, that holds all together, that creates, dissolves, and recreates.